Thank you so much for that. Well, just before we open it up for...
can I have this note that you wrote for me?
Thanks. We're going to pass the hat, not for the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism, not because we're wealthy or anything, but because the DePaul students against the war are launching a zine to counter the well-funded right-wing rag that is on this campus right now. So if you can reach deep in your pockets and help these students counter the right-wing propaganda on this campus, it'd be much appreciated. Thank you so much. And I guess I'll just open it up for questions. Yes, Chris.
You talked about the importance of alternative means to actually get the truth out to people and give them an opportunity to dialogue and help break the sort of barrier of alienation. It seems to keep so many people from feeling like going in emotion has any meaning. And one of the things that really seems to have sort of punctured the anti-war movement in the wake of those February mobilizations is people simply go, we didn't stop the war. So that must be a failed strategy. On Friday, a local musician who's also been a very active free speech and peace advocate, just around, I mean, he just comes to protests. Took a can of gasoline to the Millennium Flame over along the Kennedy Expressway, which he drove in on from the airport, poured it over himself, and struck a match. That story was reported by the local press as a traffic slowdown, the corporate press. And it was reported kind of as a suicide. He left a very lengthy obituary that he wrote for himself, and a very long letter describing why he'd done it. He was very specific about it, that this was in the tradition of the monks in Vietnam who burned themselves, of the Quakers during the Vietnam War, who with their support teams in place, struck matches to themselves, that it was an effort, a plea, to try to break people out of their complacency and bring them to an understanding of what people in places like Iraq are suffering because of this government's policies and the kind of result that produced. So, you know, projects like Chicago Indie Media Back, they're making an effort to get the story out about this because we can't seem to get reported shockingly straight from the corporate press. Both of you talked about distortion in the media, distortion in portrayal, and the importance of brass tacks organizing. I wonder if you could take a few minutes to sort of lay out the, you know, sort of top priorities in that organizing effort that you see in terms of messaging to people. And not just telling people what they ought to know or what they ought to think, but how to really make that a process of dialogue and engagement and inclusion, an invitation to work as a larger collective. Because that also seems to be something that's often missing from these large, you know, leader-found peace formations. And, you know, even their own base often feels very separated from the leaders. It feels like the leaders don't really listen to them and what they want. So, thank you.
One of the initial targets of Ronald Rumsfeld soon after the Iraq invasion began was Al Jazeera television station. Recently, in fact, Gulbarg, you were saying to me how Ronald Rumsfeld was about to hire some PR firm in order to facilitate the conversation between his sort of thuggish way of talking and the message that he wanted to get across. I think I give you these two examples by saying that there are plenty of alternative sources of information available. And in fact, I've come to the conclusion, I don't care, in fact, that the corporate media doesn't report it. I'm happier that the corporate, because can you imagine if CNN were to report a heroic, noble, however tragic accident? I mean, it takes a humanity to recognize both, not to celebrate the death of a fellow human being, but recognize the enormity of the sacrifice that the human being will do in order to do that. That is, it necessitates a kind of a subtlety of a soul that this corporate media doesn't have it. So, alternative sources of information of two nature, the internet, is an extraordinary source of information, amazingly available. Individual listservs that exist for communicating these sorts of ideas. In fact, the nightmare that Rumsfeld said that he cannot go to sleep is the availability of alternative data. Now, I just gave an example of Al Jazeera. I don't have a sort of a rosy view of Al Jazeera, or Al Jazeera is God's gift to humanity. Al Jazeera is the Arabic version of CNN. However, what does exist, this goes back to your point, is a possibility for you to have a multiple. That is, I get up in the morning, we both do, and look at European press, look at the Arab, Iranian, sort of South Asian press, and then look at the American press. You get the gist of the idea as to what is happening. Number one, internet. Number two, the sort of listservs that we generate. But more important than that, for us not to sort of creep and live into our cyberspace, but community activism. Community active in each neighborhood. The expression that I see that tomorrow is called Neighbors for Peace, I think it's called. This is what is at the issue, because ultimately, if you combine the enormity of internet, what is possible is available, and community activism, if you bring them together, corporate media, corporate media generates the assumption. I get up every morning, I cannot touch New York Times. I mean, I have to be responsible, I have a family. It gives me heart palpitation. Do you follow? But I am more informed today of events than any time in my life. By virtue of I'm not a news junkie, half an hour on the internet, and also sort of, for example, I'm on Ms. Harandi's listserv. That she sends. So a range of things, and here, this is what one of the issues, and I'll stop, I don't want to give too prolonged an answers. The fact that as a nation we are monolingual is an impediment. Activism, ladies and gentlemen, requires retooling ourselves. We need to retool ourselves, okay? And there are a number of any things that we have to do. I just began with self-criticism, that we have been sort of in this ivory tower of comfortable conversations. But the more languages you know, the better. Again, not that because it's written in Arabic is correct, but that it gives you it's like, the metaphor I always use is the metaphor of multiple lenses. If you have only one lens, it is CNN, that's all you see. But if you have multiple lenses that they can then, by virtue of your own intellect, your own experiences, your own creative involvement, you begin to begin to manipulate, then you see a better picture of reality.
The government forces are afraid of the internet, but they're not sitting idly. There is a severe and serious attack on the internet going through Congress at the present time. That is that they are attempting to allow the internet cable providers, the backbone, to charge high rates to small users. That would exclude you and I from getting information onto the internet. We need not only to protect the internet, but to find alternative ways of getting information around, because we may in fact be reduced to what they did in Iran, which was to distribute lots of audio tapes to get the information out. It isn't a guarantee that we will even retain our ability to use the internet to share information. And of course, now that the Democrats are in, people have the illusion that the Democrats are going to change that. I think they need to be coerced into doing so, because they work for the same corporations.
Thank you. Dick?
One, I also want to thank you for coming to Chicago. It is extraordinary that we're able to have voices that are so powerful and yet have been themselves under such assault. One of the things that I think certainly hope the audience is aware of is that the dissident voices coming out of places like Columbia University have not only had to contend with the media blockade and but an all-out assault inside of the academy against them. Professors like Joseph Massu the late, great, dearly beloved Dr. Edward Said. And of course, you, both of you, have seen this firsthand, the effort to demonize voices of rationality and progress in the academy by a very conscious campaign by the right wing to marginalize it. Can you talk a little bit about how that's impacted your ability to share information and what life is like at Columbia University for you under these circumstances?
Sure.
The enormity of the pressure, as you rightly say, is not to be underestimated, okay? My own predicament began soon after the Jenin massacre, that we had a demonstration in at Columbia, and soon after that when I organized the Palestinian Film Festival, and soon after that because I organized something called U.S. Imperialism in 21st Century, and then the 25th anniversary, Edward Said was still alive. I organized the 25th anniversary of the publication of Orientalism. And I became enemy number one. My picture, I mean, I like to see, I'm sort of moderately handsome man. the pictures of me that appeared in the front page of the New York, the tabloid, made me look like a two-headed monster that eats his own children. And then the viciousness with which they went around the country to find a single student of mine to come and say that I had done something wrong, and they couldn't. And all they could was to go and find an article that I had published in Egypt, a travelogue of mine to think, and then take words out and put words in. And then manufacture a so-called documentary and show it around the world, from Tel Aviv to New York to Philadelphia, etc. I mean, it began, in fact, soon after September 11th, and Lynn Cheney created a list called Suspicious Professors. And two people made it from Columbia. It was Eric Forner, my historian colleague, and I were suspicious professors. And then soon after that, the Campus Watch, that six dossiers were created, and I was one of the six. And I mean, I've actually come down in my significance. I was one of two, then I was one of six, but now I'm one of 101 most dangerous professors. I mean, I can move. Character assassination. They go. See, the thing is that I've always said that it is not the intellectual freedom; it is our civil liberties which are at the stake. That is, I am attacked, or people like me are attacked, not because we say anything in our classrooms. Because that's an entirely different context, but because we go out in the public, and what we say in the public is not what they like. However, there's a medieval mystic, Iranian mystic, is a fantastic, who says when, in his language, when God loves somebody, puts his reputation on the wing of his enemies. That is, I have had more signs of solidarity coming towards me over the last 500 years. People who never knew who I was. I was this obscure professor. I beg your pardon?
5 years.
What did I say?
5 years.
Looks like 500.
It just felt like 500.
There are publishers. I'm just in London. We were in London. I met with my publisher in London, Verso. And they have collected this man's book, 101 Most Dangerous Professors, to look which author they missed. And do you follow? So there are other sides of this, that more solidarity, more determination, more. I recently wrote something about Native Informers and this ghastly thing that has been written. This morning, just before I came, I had a fantastic email from a colleague who's a professor of English literature and comparative English literature and comparative literature from Idaho. I never heard of who had written an article precisely with the same conclusion that I had, but from a perspective of a literary theorist, but hadn't published it. I just was collecting dust in. I said, when I saw your article, I realized, you know, I was so here. Look, I said it before you. So all the power to you. You know, why don't you publish it? So there are two sides to this. Okay, they inadvertently they go and they become carrier of a message. They think that they are demonizing you. And in fact, I mean, I don't want to glorify it. I came with shingles during the most recent attacks. It's not easy for your name, for your dignity, for your reputation. And they go, they know precisely what your weak points is. I'm a teacher. I was born a teacher. And they go precisely where it is, that is your students, that you are abusing your students. It is exceedingly hurtful for me to receive emails. Professor Dabashi, I was your student in 1995, and I am a Jewish student, and you never did anything to... why should I receive this email? Why should a student of mine being forced into... I don't even know who is... at a moment during the teaching, I don't even recognize the gender of the students, let alone if they are Jewish. How can I tell? Do you follow? So I don't want to diminish those really hurtful way that they want to... dissuade you from going to the public, to harass you. My daughter is sitting in a classroom. Suddenly, my colleague tells me, there is an NYPD guy sitting next to your daughter, tell her to be careful. And I told my daughter, Paris, I hear there's this guy sitting next to you in the classroom. I said, yeah, Dad, I think he's hitting on me. I said, no, he's an NYPD. NYPD collecting what from my daughter? There's nothing I say to my daughter that I don't... In fact, my daughter is not political at all. Anytime I want to say something about politics, I don't want to hear it. You ruined everything for me. The point is not to share the pain that it's caused, but in terms of the solidarity that it generates. Okay, solidarity from most outlandish places. I received an invitation from Voice of America, the Bush administration has given some millions of dollars in order to propagate a thing, to go and talk. I go and talk. I don't care. I go anywhere if they invite me. And then I create havoc there. So pain is a lot, but there is a reverse side of it that they don't know, or I don't know what it is, that is equally important and far more gratifying.
Say something about your question. I mean, Hamid is a tenured professor and they can't just sack him. But I signed an anti-war petition this summer against the invasion of Lebanon by the Israeli forces. And my name appeared in a New York tabloid and it was very scary. And if you want to have an academic career in this country, you can't go on and be politically active. So you have a lot of young scholars who don't dare talk. They don't publish anything, you know, that might, you know, seem contentious or anything like that. So, and Joseph Massad that you mentioned, he might not get tenured at Columbia just because, you know, he has said what he said. And so there is this other aspect to it for junior scholars that, you know, they don't let you be a public intellectual. They don't let you be politically active and anti-war activist because... yeah, they don't want those sort of people in university, so it is very scary.
Unless you're a suitable public
intellectual. Yeah.
And Juan Cole had the same experience.
Absolutely.
And denied that position.
Position at Yale, exactly. So it's not fun. It's very lonely. You get very scared, and you get, you know, death threats. You get obscene emails. So unless you have a lot of friends and you get nice emails, it can be horrible. You feel very isolated, and if you are someone who's been, you know, like Hamid, who's been doing what he's doing for such a long time, and then suddenly your reputation, your name, your picture, your dignity is out in tabloids, and you have people who have absolutely no clue who you are, you know, swearing at you and saying obscene things, blogs, the whole internet being full of really horrible things. But it's not, I mean, psychologically, it's very difficult.
That's it, question. Thank you so much for coming here and going back.
Thanks.
It was a pleasure to be your audience. I wanted to ask you this. What do you think that if Americans overcome, they absorb this notion that God has not blessed them to be the nation who puts the most notorious individuals in power to be in charge of the world, the only country who has used the atomic bombs, the country who has the atrocity, the crimes, you know, according to Kinzer, over 50 countries. We go to Latin America, we go to Asia, Philippines, Indonesia, you know, all over, you know. This notion that, you know, we are in charge, well, what the heck? Oh, now we are so busy with Iraq and then whatever, that now North Korea is in a way better. Who gives a damn? Why? Why, if American people ask this question, that who the hell are we to be the watchdog of the world with no respect for any laws, for humanities? We commit the most notorious war crimes and get away, and we support the most notorious regimes, the most backward, the most notorious, the most, you know, to take Saudi Arabia, Israel, you know, Pakistan, you know, here, there, everywhere. This is what we have to work on, that American people finally realize that they have not been blessed to put the most notorious people in power to be in charge of the world.
If there is a God, who blesses, well, Americans are as much entitled to be blessed by that God as anybody else. The underlying point of your comment is absolutely correct. That is, Kinzer has documented from Hawaii to Saddam Hussein consistently, United States going around the world and changing regimes and so forth and so on. But for as many years there have been resistances. Sometimes, in a moment of despair, I say that the worst thing about the United States is that there is always hope for it. You follow? That it's a civil war of ideas. We have a vision of United States. We are also Americans. And it is the legitimacy of that vision that leads me to say that if we safeguard our civil liberties, exercise our civil liberties, and demand and exact from our elected officials that this is a free and democratic republic that must remain a free and democratic republic and not mutated into a predatory empire, that is, in that way, if there is a God and that God blesses certain people, I don't mind that country be blessed and become a shining example for other countries. But you don't become a shining example for other countries by dropping bomb on them, by experimenting with new weapons on them, by launching a campaign of shock and awe on them. Soon after a mosque was blown up in Samarra somewhere, I was in an radio interview, and they asked me, so what is the wrong with the Sunnis and the Shi'is, and what's the wrong with them? What are they fighting for? What is their theology? I said, listen, you really don't need Arabic, you don't need Persian, you don't need Turkish and Urdu and medieval theocracy. Campaign of shock and awe is plain English. I was an American, blue-blooded American, who said it. When you unleash so much violence in a space, it's bound to just reverberate, ricochet, go back, come in various forms. So it is what I don't think that Bush and Rumsfeld, etc., were accidental to American culture. They are here, and they will, and if there is a democratic election, etc., they will not disappear. And the only way to oppose it is by consistently positing the alternative, coming out of the shelter, engaging in human communication, abandoning your comfortable zones of talking only to the convert. I mean, against all trepidations, I actually went and sat next to Alan Dershowitz. My wife has a picture of my name and Alan Dershowitz, Hamid Abouji, Alan Dershowitz. Otherwise, if we only, I mean, this is a different kind of activism. I'm talking to my fellow activists as to how to go out, and if somebody says, Islamic Republic should not have an atomic bomb, the answer is yes, Islamic Republic should not have atomic bomb. But Islamic Republic is surrounded by four nuclear powers, Russia, Pakistan, Israel, United States. none of them is in a moral or even a military position to point finger and say, oh, you bad boy, you can't have a nuclear thing. And as citizens, if we are in a room with four people with bazookas in their hands, we wouldn't feel particularly more safe if a fifth person comes and has another bazooka in his hand, right? So what do we say? Say, okay, as anti-war activists, what we say, regional disarmament. Israel, please put your nuclear things on the table. I mean, everybody knows you have it. And then it is not by demonizing Israel. 7 million people, 20% of them are Palestinians, live in Israel. Has nuclear capability of Israel secured a peaceful life for 7 million Israelis? Go ask Israeli mothers whose children are being blown up. A kid. A 15-year-old kid can strap ammunition around herself or himself, blow herself up, and everything inside. Well, what does a nuclear capability give to you? Or is it psychological security? What psychological security? So let's talk about regional disarmament. Let's talk about NPT. Let's everybody, including, let's first of all, have Israel sign NPT, be a signatory to NPT. Second, United States be held accountable by current status of NPT. Then if NPT is not sufficient, let's go back to the drawing table, map the NPT. Regional disarmament. Nobody should have, or not that should you, Iran have or not, or is it, of course. And then they come tell me, oh, you disregard the horrors of Islamic Republic. For a quarter of a century, I've been talking against Islamic rule. I can't put foot on the goddamn country. They send me to jail. So you're not in a position to tell me Islamic Republic is a horror theocracy. Of course it is. Who do you think you're talking to? So it is to rob them of this thing that you say, and that will not happen until and unless people who, whatever, this is what I have, this is what Goldberg had, this is what we know by virtue of our biography, knowledge, education, etc. You put it on the table, you generate collective knowledge that we go out, talk, so nobody can say, oh, if you are against invasion, then you are an Islamist, or you're pro Islamist, or you're an apologist.
I think we're going to take one or two more questions and wrap it up. There's a young woman here who's been trying to speak.
I hate to bring it back to the issue of the internet, but I feel very strongly about my generation that, I see the value in the internet as a tool for information, but I also see it as an impediment towards this community-based involvement, where, I mean, I don't know, you know, maybe a generation or so ago, how the internet is, you know, it's just kind of this new invention, but for people in my generation, it's just a way of life, and it's taken for granted, and we're isolated by it, and when you are surfing the internet for this information, it is you and a computer. So I find it very difficult to be excited about this idea of creating solidarity and talking to other people and creating these movements, because I feel that's where the power is in numbers of people getting together and exchanging ideas, as you talk about, but I find it very difficult to even find a forum for that, or for to even know how to talk to people anymore. So I guess I'm not necessarily posing a specific question, but just kind of probing your thoughts and perhaps observations.
I absolutely agree with you that there is a tremendous danger in internet because it creates simulacrum of solidarity, understanding, etc. But that is part of a more general sort of technological mutation of us as human beings, that we put this iPod into our ears and we have our phone. I sit in the subway in New York. I want to ask a person a direction. I can't have a human contact. I can't the eye contact. So that's part of a larger issue. Do you follow that? That I'm not antiquarian. I don't miss all those good old days that people didn't have internet. Internet technology advancements, etc., things happened. Are part and parcel of the technological modernity happened. The question is how to use them effectively. okay, and how to have, for example, we established curfews for that we were not going to check emails or et cetera. We force ours. Right here, for example, would have been much easier to stay in New York and have the publishers sort of breathing down our necks for our, et cetera. But pulling yourself out of your cocoon, coming for this precise conversation that you and I are having, is the way that as a committed activist, you generate and sustain. And then you carry it from this gathering to some other gathering, not to the point of discarding internet, internet is bad, but how to use it creatively, selectively, judiciously in order to buttress your communal activism. Because without it, the positive side of the internet is that you have enormous access to information. Tomorrow morning, you can get up and read the paper in Tel Aviv before the people in Israel have read it, or in Al Jazeera, or in India, whatever. This is unbelievable power. But as all good things, contrary to what Mae West said, it sometimes a little bit too much of a good thing is fabulous, you remember, is bad. So you just use it judiciously. You use it in a way that empowers, you never lose your eye contact with what is important. And what is important is 300 million people in this country, and in our name, horrible, horrible criminal activities are being done. And how? What do we do in order to stop it? And when you have that in mind, and then also the decency of your own personal, private life, social life, professional life, etc. So activism is not something that is left to the activist. Activism has to be integral to ordinary human beings who have a 9-to-5 job and then devote 1, 2 hours, 3 hours, weekend, whatever, into this collective concern that all of us have to have. In that way, if you do it in proportion, judiciously, and creatively, and not allow it to swallow you, I think is a good thing. But it requires human agency for you to interact.
Thank you. All righty. I think Andy just wants to say a couple words, and then we'll start to wrap it up.
Just very quickly, someone once said the philosopher has interpreted the world. The point is to change it. And whether or not you're familiar with that particular author of that quote, the point is to change it. We'd encourage you all to become members of the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism. As you might expect us going into the holidays at this point, we are beginning to make preliminary plans to organize around the 4th anniversary of the invasion. Those of you who are familiar with past year's battles know that it has been a battle not just against the war itself, but for our civil liberties. We won a big victory last year in terms of being, for the first time since the mass arrests at the beginning of the war, to legally march on Michigan Avenue. But any number of you who've been around to demonstrations over the past few months know that the city is increasingly using things like the disorderly conduct ordinance and every trick bag in its book to prevent people from organizing against this war. And so I'd encourage you to, if you haven't already, to sign up on that mailing list that went around. We'll let you know about what's going on in terms of organizing on the 4th anniversary of the start of the current war. I think it's important to get involved with that, to use the knowledge that we learned tonight to actually put that into action. So please sign up on that mailing list. There's others at the back. Please check out the literature table. Check out our website, www.ccawr, and we'll be posting information just as soon as it becomes available there as well. Thank you.
All right.